Welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. Now here's your host, DeAndrew.
And welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, also broadcast live on UPRN 105.5 New Orleans. I'm your host, DeAndrew, and tonight my guest is Travis Walton. Well, the Roswell crash, Sag Harbor, the Rendlesham Forest incident, the Phoenix Lights, mass sightings, and many other cases are easily recognizable when discussing the topic of UFOs. Names like Betty and Barney Hill, Whitley Strieber, and Travis Walton have become synonymous with close encounter events. What happened in November of 1975 to Travis Walton has become one of the most well-known close encounter cases to date. Travis was eventually able to put his telling of these events to paper, which resulted in his book, Fire in the Sky. Later on, a movie of the same name was made about Travis's experience, but unfortunately, the movie was only loosely based on what really happened to him. The book Fire in the Sky has been out of print for some time now, and my copy of the original printing holds a very special place in my own book collection. I was quite pleased when Travis informed me via email that he had been able to arrange an updated version of his book to be reprinted. Travis Walton is someone who I've wanted to have on my program as a guest for a long time now, and it is my honor and my great pleasure to finally be able to welcome him to the program as my guest this evening. And welcome, Travis.
Hi, Dee. How are you doing?
I'm doing really good this evening. I'm like so stoked that you're on my program tonight. I have been a big proponent of getting the truth about what happened to you in November of 75 out to the public, you know, to dispel the myth that the movie created. And I'm so excited that you're on tonight to help me help you get the truth out there.
Well, I would say the myth that the movie and the skeptics created.
This is true. This is very true. With skeptics, the biggest thorn in your side was Phil Klass.
Yeah. Used all sorts of very devious tactics to try to discredit it, but totally failed.
Which you thankfully meticulously explained all of that. What kind of, well,
yeah,
easiest way to put it would to discredit the BS that he tried to pass off as
I
know,
took
what happened.
Each and every charge that he leveled and any other skeptic, and like you say, very meticulously laid out the sources of independently verifiable information that people could go to show that in many most cases that they were just untrue, and in some cases just totally falsified.
From what I understand from Virtual Auditorium, your volume's just a little bit low. If you could speak up just a little bit, cause I want to make sure everybody hears you.
Okay.
Oh, much better. Yeah, I mean, Phil Klass, if I remember correctly, on live TV, called you a liar to your face. I mean, how rude can a person be?
Well, he was saying that to Mike Rogers, but he was essentially saying that to all seven of the crew and a few of my relatives too. But, you know, he would just use anything on that Larry King show that you're referring to and in his book. In his book, he did the same thing he did on Larry King. In the same paragraph, he said that the ground was rocky and should have bruised me, and it was also covered with a thick carpet of pine needles that should have burst into flames. Now, it can't be both, but he's going to use both, you know. Saying that the beam should have caused the pine needles to burst into flame. Well, why didn't it catch my clothes on fire? You know, most of it hit me. So why would anything that went past me start the pine needles on fire and not burn me up? It's just, you know, like I said on Larry King, he had no idea the nature of the energy in that beam, you know, what it was like and whether it would start a fire or what it would do, you know. But just devious tactics all over the place. He took a quotation where Mike Rogers had heard that that Steve had been offered money to deny it, and I think the offer actually came from Philip Glass. Mike said that he'd heard that Steve was considering taking it, and he'd say, you know, if you would lie, even though you know it really happened, to take the money, you know, then you'll be bruised. And so Phil Klass took that and quotation and cut out the part where he said, even though you know it really happened, and just tried to make it look like Mike had just threatened him about repudiating the incident. And, you know, to alter a quotation to reverse its meaning is just about as deceitful and lying as you can get. But there was all kinds of examples of that where he would take documents and alter them, and recordings and alter them. And one of those came up on Larry King where he changed the beaker in order to change the meaning. Said that a quotation came from Fred Sylvanus when it actually came from Mike Rogers. But enough about that. There was another deal on Larry King here just recently where Stephen Hawking came on, and you know he was having some kind of a special about life out there and like that, and he was being asked the question about whether we'd ever been visited. Now, on this show, Dan Aykroyd and some other investigators, UFO investigators, were on there. And Dan Aykroyd, although he's an actor, is also a MUFON official. But he brought up my case as evidence of that they had been here. And then Larry King asked Stephen Hawking, the physicist, whether we had already been visited here, and Stephen Hawking replied, no, except perhaps in the state of Arizona. And, I couldn't tell whether he was joking or not, because, you know, he uses that voice synthesizer, but Larry King laughed like he thought it was a joke. But I don't know, I guess I'll leave that up to your audience, whether Stephen Hawking was acknowledging a possible exception. Although you've got to understand that, you know, his position about have they been here is really trying to maintain a reputation with the mainstream scientists whose official position is they haven't been here.
Well, but there's a lot of mainstream scientists that are now, acknowledging that there has to be life out there other than just us.
Oh, yeah, it's becoming safer to say so. Oh, a week ago, they announced the data gathered by a probe that we'd sent out that had identified over 700 Earth-type possibilities. And, of course, these will be confirmed with other, telescopes they're going to put out into space. But, you know, it's really rather recent that and certainly since my incident, that they had actually been able to confirm the existence of any planets orbiting suns other than our own. So we've come a long way, and I think in the minds of the average person, it's absurd to think otherwise. I mean, people who want to think that we're alone in the universe are in a class more ignorant than the flat earthers, because it just would be outrageously contrary to common sense to think that there are billions of suns like ours, and they've just been put out there to twinkle at us at night, and life exists nowhere in this vast cosmos except right here on this little earth, you know.
This little blue marble, yes. Last year at Roswell, my husband and I got the honor of being able to listen to you speak about your experiences. And when it was over and everything, my husband and I both turned to each other and almost at the same time said, you could see it still bothered him to talk about it.
Yeah, that's true. It really does. You know, when I get into the actual experience aboard the craft and, you know, to talk about it is to sort of relive it again. And it's a little easier to do than it used to be. But, you know, it's still with me. It's still with all of us. You know, the youngest guy on the crew, Steve Pierce, called me up a few months ago. And I hadn't heard from him in over 30 years. He really didn't want anything to do with what had happened. He was so traumatized, his family said he didn't even want to go outside at night. And he was also kind of upset, you know, I think disproportionately, you know, when stories came out that he had been one of the ones that was still crying when the sheriff came to interview the crew, you know, he came over to my house and he wanted to fight, you know. But, you know, I talked to him and it made him understand, you know, he wasn't the only one crying. And if anybody was the most scared, it was me. So I think we've kind of patched things up over that issue because, you know, a lot of guilt and finger-pointing came in the direction of the crew because they did leave when they saw me hit by that beam. But,
well, they all thought you were dead.
Yeah, they thought it had killed me, and so it was totally understandable that they would think that there was no helping me, and to stay there would just, you know, make them one more casualty, so or six more. So I always try to emphasize that their fleeing was not cowardly, as some people have implied. It was only common sense. What was exceptional, though, was that they did have the courage to return. They came back, you know, and that took guts.
Oh, I agree. I mean, gosh, I've seen the movie Fire in the Sky quite a few times, and, you know, I think I would have probably reacted the same way, you know, scared, and, you know, these men thought they were running for their very lives.
Well, the crew kind of got shortchanged in the movie because it made Mike out to be the lone hero. But when he said, if you guys don't want to come back with me, you can get out right here and wait for me, none of those guys said yes. They're not about to stand out there in the dark by themselves. So, yeah, they all went back. And like I say, that took courage because, you know, nobody would have faulted them if they just continued on to you know, gets help.
Boy, people in our virtual auditorium here in Pal Talk are already got a bunch of questions lined up. And if you don't mind, there's a couple here that I think are quite good that I'd like to ask you for them.
Yeah, let's hear them.
Okay, the first one is from Tall Dwarf, and Tall Dwarf asks, in a second contact or abduction, what would you do now? Would you do the same?
Well, the answer is no, I would not get out and approach it. And B, if I was dumb enough to do that, I wouldn't tell anybody because, you know, I've been, you know, complimented on having the courage to come forward and talk about this, but it really wasn't a choice on my part. It was an international news story by the time I was returned, and so, you know, I'm no hero in that sense. I just was responding to, you know, people's questions after that, man. And so, what was the other part of this question?
If there was a second contact, what would you do instead of going?
Well, you know, it's also just, you know, it's the long-term effects on my life. You know, I've not been pleasant, so I really don't need any more of that.
Don't blame you there. I mean, holy cow, was like you said this before you returned. You were gone for 5 days, and in that 5 days, it became a worldwide story. You know, not only were you having to deal with what happened, you were dealing with worldwide media.
Yeah, hard on the heels of they killed him and made up a story to cover it up. Came the accusations that I'd had a transitory psychosis or a drug hallucination. But you know, tests that the investigators did, and this is what's meant by documented case. You know, these tests and these the results of them from these experts are independently verifiable. That I, you know, had a battery of psychiatric exams that showed that I was perfectly sane and normal, and I had the blood and urine samples put to the county medical examiner's drug screen, which showed not a trace of any drug in my body. So, you know, I don't know why the media would jump on such theories in the first place, since seven people do not have identical hallucinations or identical, psychoses. It just doesn't happen.
Oh, that's, I agree with you 100% on that. That goes with any sighting. Our next question is from Loonster, and this was one I was going to ask you about as well. Loonster asks, what does Travis Walton think of the polygraph tests he took? Did he pass those polygraph tests, and how many times did he take them?
Well, I recently, in the new book documents this last set of tests in detail, I went looking for the most rigorous new test that I could get. And since polygraph results are admissible in court in the state of New Mexico, it's very carefully regulated by statute there. So I went there, and other polygraph examiners recommended one as being the best. And he does work for the Albuquerque Police Department, the New Mexico State Prison, and even the United States Marshal's Office. And he was using a modern machine, unlike any of the previous tests I'd passed, that had five traces. And it was digitally monitored and scored by computer at the same time the examiner scored it. And I passed on all accounts at the highest level on two separate tests. So I have passed six different polygraph tests from three different examiners, spaced at the intervals over time since the incident happened immediately after, about halfway through, and then just recently. And enough already on that question. You know, there's now over 15 positive polygraph tests from various people involved in this incident.
Wow, I was unaware of the recent polygraph.
Yeah, that's a new one. That's in the updated book, some other new documentation in there. It's 25 pages longer than the previous edition, and there's also some additional illustrations. But just catching everybody up on a lot of questions about what's happened in the recent years.
I can't wait to get my hands on a copy myself to go along with the copy you so graciously signed for me in Roswell this last summer.
That one was probably, that's the early edition.
Very early edition.
Yeah, I mean the earlier edition. That's not the update.
Exactly. I think it would be I'd like to have the update to go with the original printing. I was wondering how many polygraphs did the guys that were with you take, and how many, and of course, you know that there was one that was indeterminate. But
well, you know, it was announced at the time that Alan Dallas's test was inconclusive. But when we got a hold of the police file, there was a report written by an officer in there that said that the results of Alan's test said that he had basically told the truth, quote unquote. And I put that in the book. But it was announced as an inconclusive because he got into an argument with the examiner. See, all polygraph tests, you know, will go through, they're supposed to anyway, go through the test questions three times. And Alan went through two, got into an argument with the examiner, and left without finishing his third run-through. And that's what earned him an inconclusive. But he was one of the ones that was retested back in 93. And, and he ended with more modern methods and from the same examiner. And he passed at the highest level. Scores are in the upper 90 percentile. Nobody gets 100%. Also, Mike Rogers, although he passed back the original test, he also was retested. And at that same time, I took two additional tests. So the first two I took were soon after, and then the next two were like 17 years later, and then the next two. So 2, 4, 6 spaced out pretty much across the three decades.
You know, that is another question from our virtual auditorium. This one's from Skymon. He says, Travis, I know you've talked about this 1,000 times, but two things I would like to know. What did their mouth look like? Was it small? And what did their legs look like?
Well, when you say they, we're, I'm going to assume you're talking about the small creatures that I first awoke to. And they had a very small mouth, and they did not open them, so I don't know anything about the interior of their mouth, you know, whether they had teeth or what. And they didn't do any speaking or anything like that, so there wasn't a lot of movement. Their faces weren't frozen, you know. I mean, there was slight, subtle movement. They were very alive-looking, but they weren't talking. Now, their legs were covered with coveralls, but when they left the room, they moved in a very quick, light sort of movement. I would say scurry was a good squirrel-like movement, actually, you know, to compare it to one of my little friends in the woods. But you know, it's the kind of body language that was consistent with a very light body weight. Because when I was lying there on the table and I tried to push them away from me, you know, the one that I made contact with fell back much easier than I expected. So a lot of people are very curious about the legs. They keep, they seem to think that there must be something robotic about them. But, and I get a lot of questions, do they seem robotic? But, you know, if you had a technology that was sophisticated enough to create a robot that could function, take the place of a human being, it's not much of a stretch to think that they would make one that would be indistinguishable, if, especially if that was their intention.
Valid point. I hadn't thought of it quite that way, because I have heard the same idea from several different people, saying that they moved almost in a robotic way. I have another question here from our virtual auditorium. Actually, this one's from my husband, David. He asks, the image that Mike Rogers did of the first beings you encountered, how accurate is that image to what you remember?
Well, the paintings that you're referring to are in the book, and, you know, they're as good as I could get with Mike. He's a pretty talented guy, and he did over 20 different versions before I picked the one that was closest. You know, of course there's something lacking there, you know, and in total reality. He did a good job, but I've been looking for another artist. I'd be willing to work with somebody to try to refine that. I'm not on all that good of terms with Mike, or I'd have him work on, further on it, but it's pretty darn close, you know, and there's no major departures from what I saw there. It's just, you know, subtleties that I would like to get brought out. The eyes were very large, and they had a really powerful effect on me for some reason, and that was one of the things that, you know, really was at the forefront in all of my nightmares for quite some time afterward.
That seems to be common in a lot of abduction cases, is the nightmares of them staring back at you, so to speak. When you gave your talk in Roswell last year, you mentioned that a person that was former military intelligence had gotten in contact with you. I thought that was quite interesting. I'd like to let our listeners know about that.
Yeah, that is a real curiosity that, you know, I keep coming back to in my thinking, even more so as time goes on. Oh, and by the way, I'll be speaking at Roswell again this year, this time at the museum. But anyway, what happened was that this guy called up, and this was, you know, after I'd been doing quite a few interviews for the movie, and, you know, and got him to thinking about it, and he wanted to come forward and say that he had to admit that he had seen it back then when it happened, that he'd been in the area, and he'd always felt bad that he didn't come forward and corroborate our report. He had been out there deer hunting with his wife, and he said that even though he was divorced from her now, that she would corroborate that they had been there. But the thing that really got me was his ability to describe the surrounding terrain. You know, this is rugged backcountry, and it's information that wasn't publicly available. So, you know, what he described seeing made me think that, yeah, he really been there. And so I called Tracy Torme and gave him the contact information, thought that was pretty interesting. Well, I never gave it any more thought, and but Tracy apparently talked with him, and Paramount flew him out to Hollywood and interviewed him, and something made them suspicious, or at least want to confirm what he was saying, and they had him polygraphed, and with some very strange results. He passed the part about being there. He passed the part about seeing the glow of the craft and the light from the beam. But and he passed the part about being in military intelligence at the time. See, this was the thing that kind of, you know, he was bringing it out as sort of, you know, a qualification as a witness. But to me, you know, as time's gone on, that's kind of alarming to think, what are the odds that someone with a high-powered rifle from military intelligence is standing that close to such a unique event, you know? But anyway, he had said that he'd been stationed in Texas at the time, and he'd gone to his superiors and said, should I come forward and testify to what I'd seen? These guys have been accused of murder. And his superiors said, well, they haven't been indicted, and unless they are, just stay out of it. So he didn't, but always felt that he, you know, hadn't done his full duty to talk about it. So that was good. But then when he was tested, he passed the part about all that, but when they questioned him about any sort of a relationship with the debunkers of people out to discredit this incident, he flunked. You know, he was at the top on one of questions and at the bottom on another, and so that was kind of strange. And that's always kind of bothered me, you know. Well, it's just, what are the odds? Of course, you know, coincidences do happen, but that's a pretty big coincidence. But other things that I learned later, in more recent years, I was speaking to a lady who was a reporter for one of the local papers, and she had been working for the Forest Service as a fire lookout during the summers back in those years. And the Deer Springs lookout is just the closest one to Turkey Springs where this happened. And that tower is over to the west. And in the months after this incident, she said that a government crew came by with all these instruments that they had been taking magnetic readings and mapping them out on the ground. And I thought that was really curious because a UFO investigative group had come to the site during the search while I was missing, and they had had some magnetic meters, some, you know, what they call Gauss meters, and they had gridded out some really remarkable readings at the site, you know, where there was this big polarity reversal at the edge of the clearing in the direction the craft had departed. So that was reported, and then the government sends in a crew to do magnetic readings on the ground. I know that, you know, the surveys of this sort are made from the air, where they put instruments on a long cable hanging from a plane and, you know, fly a grid over an area, but I just never heard of anybody trying to map them out on the foot, on the ground. See, back in 1975, the GPS satellite system did not exist. There wouldn't even be a positive way for those federal guys to accurately locate themselves on the ground, you know, other than, you know, with survey type measurements. I don't know, maybe they may have had some sort of aerial photo thing in place, whatever, but nevertheless, to do it on the ground in person with such a number of people was kind of, and again, not impossible. There was another something else going on there, but in conjunction with other actions by federal officials, it just all adds up to point to something. That, see, you know, we talk about the entities, and what gets glossed over, just like they left it out of the movie, was that there was two types of beings involved, and the ones that looked so human, you know, they may have been officers of some Earth-based agency. Whether they were or not, you know, the fact that that's ignored is kind of curious to me because, you know, if there's somebody there that looks like people, that could be, you know, the key to the whole thing. But people really don't express all that much curiosity about them as compared to these creatures, you know. Of course, in the aftermath of the whole thing, you know, the thing that was the most traumatic to me, of course, was these creatures, because that was just so bizarre to see that.
Actually, that idea of them being some kind of, you know, Earth-based military group was just being bantered about here in the virtual auditorium, as you were just before you mentioned that. But yeah, that's an interesting thought. You know, I had thought about that a few times myself, but you're right, it isn't something that's talked about.
Yeah, there's been so many reports, not just the movie, where they don't even mention the human ones. They just say, oh, you saw these creatures and this is what they look like, but it just gloss right over the rest of that. But that's kind of curious. And, you know, it brings to mind several possibilities, several theories. Either some government agency knew there was some UFO activity in that area, and they were there to monitor that, look into that, you know, or they were cooperating with them in some way, or they created this. I went online and looked up Google mind control, and man, oh man, you know, our government and other governments on this planet have been real busy in the secret stuff that leaks out. They've made some real progress in mind control. And if that's what this was, it was extremely successful because there was nothing more real than, to us than what happened. So,
well, I agree with that.
I've always accepted the terminology spacecraft, aliens, you know, for want of a better word, but I really have tried to stick as best I could to what I saw and how it looked. And, you know, the conclusion is, you know, most likely extraterrestrial, but doesn't exclude the possibility that they're from our past or our future, or from another dimension, or even, you know, created by some Earth agency.
There's been some talk that the reason why they resemble each other so much, as you described in your book, that they look like they were from the same family line, same features and whatnot. One idea that's bantered about is that they're clones.
Yeah, I've heard that, and that's possible. But then, you know, when you're unfamiliar with the subtle variations, and even other races on Earth, people tend to think they look more alike than people who are familiar with that race do. You know, it's just that you're not, you know, tuned into to the differences. It's kind of like, you know, when I was growing up, I knew every make and model of car, and now, to me, it's really kind of hard to tell a lot of these makes and models apart, but my son can tell me right off the bat, you know, well, that one's a Ford, that one's a Chevy. I'm just not as good at distinguishing those as I used to be. But, you know, there's so many explanations, and I really have tried to stick to just what I saw. Although I do think probably the most likely explanation is extraterrestrial. You know, it's probably worth adding that maybe we shouldn't be quite so, you know, blown away by all this, you know. One day, you know, other beings from other worlds may be commonplace enough to where it's just like those really different people from that country way over there that we don't know too much about, rather than being this sort of monstrous or almost supernatural attitude that we've taken towards it.
True, very true. We have another question from our virtual auditorium, this one again from Munster, and he would like to know, what was your take on UFOs and ETs before your personal experience?
Well, it was, you know, I had wide-ranging interest. You know, we used to talk about everything, you know, on the way to work, and there was even some talk of cattle mutilations in this area that made the paper. And that had come up in discussions. And, you know, I'd had a family member that had had a sighting 8 or 10 years before. And so it wasn't something that I had never thought of or disbelieved in. I was open to that possibility for sure. But it definitely was not any kind of a hobby of mine. You know, I'd never bought any books on the subject or joined any UFO organizations or anything like that. But, you know, it's just something that I think most people acknowledge as one of the, at least in our, you know, popular understanding, that it's at least a possibility, you know, at least something that's thought about.
Another question here from our virtual auditorium, and this is from Cartoonist, and he asks, you said that during your abduction you saw humans. Is it possible that your abductors hypnotized you into seeing them in that form to calm you down?
Yeah, it is possible that, you know, that this was some kind of an illusion that they could have generated. But they, you know, when they were forcing me down on the table, the larger human ones, they were strong, and the weight of them pushing me down and everything was totally consistent with them being really don't, I can't say for sure, you know. I don't even know whether, you know, these humans were acting as rescuers, like they were staging an intervention here, or whether they were assisting in some sort of cooperative effort, or were acting subserviently to the creatures. I couldn't say, because I didn't see them together.
Valid point. You know, one thing that I was always curious about, when the first human-looking being, the one with the helmet, took you out of the craft that you were originally in and into the hangar, for lack of a better terminology, mm-hmm. and saw these different crafts sitting there, were they all alike, or were they different? Or
no, there was a different configuration. Although they were metallic discs, the one that we came out of was shaped the same as the one in the woods, only it wasn't giving off any light. It wasn't flying. It was sitting, landed. And it was larger. But the other ones that were in there were shinier and more rounded. So there were two different types of discs of a similar size, but not even exactly the same size. So, you know, if that lends support to theory that there's two distinct beings there, because why else would they have two craft? It's possible that the creatures could have had two kinds of craft, and that the humans were just Earth people that they had enlisted in some way.
I always explain the different configurations. Well, we've got different configurations of cars. We've got different configurations of airplanes. Why not you know, different configurations of spacecraft?
Yeah. For some reason, they seem to need to be circular in some dimension, although we have these triangular things, too. I don't know. What was the next question?
This one is from Rydell, and he says, maybe Lorenzen was right, though the blue beam could have accidentally killed you, they could have revived you. They must have had a reason for wanting you alive and returning you.
Yeah, I like that theory the best, too. You know, Tracy Torme liked that one. That basically what happened was that however I got injured, it was more of an accident. You know, probably brought about by the fact that I just got too close in an unexpected way. And so they had to clean up the mess and resuscitate me or repair the damage or something. Or at least make sure I was okay.
I'm reading another question here. Part of this has already been answered. So, tall dwarf, yeah, that was basically my own question. So, it was on the different configurations and shapes of the craft in the hangar room. Another aspect that I always thought was quite interesting was the first room that you walked into that had the chair in the middle. Gosh, I tried to figure out what this room could possibly have been. Either, you know, the way the ship was piloted, or just a nap room, I guess you could call it.
Yeah, one or the other, most likely. Yeah, that's what I would think, you know, just a very curious situation. That why would they even need to see it like that? I don't know. I guess maybe they just like to, the way we would like to see where we're going. Of course, you can fly by wire in these airplanes, and you know how these 747s, you know, the pilots aren't really seeing where they're going. They're basically flying off of instruments. You know, and I'm sure that if the windows were blacked out, they could taxi and and take off and land, and would never really need to look outside that windscreen. But we'd rather.
Did it look more like it was a projection on the wall, or like a TV screen?
I don't know. You know, I don't know whether it was a projection or maybe some way that the molecules could align or something, and some way that the light coming from outside could somehow be seen through the material. You know, I don't know whether it was projected on or being seen through. You know, a dark background and points of light. I couldn't tell.
Oh, that's understandable. That's very understandable. Something else that's being bantered around here in our virtual auditorium is whether you were conscious or not when you were picked up off the ground and taken aboard.
I was unconscious. Once they knocked me out with that beam, and the crew said it was incredibly powerful. You know, that it was like it turned night into brighter than day, and the blast was so powerful. You know, in the movie they played that way down. It looked like some kind of a spotlight came on and just sort of tossed the actor back, but they said it was like a grenade, like a stick of dynamite just blasting me back. And one of the crew guys, Dwayne Smith, said that, you know, and he told me this after he, you know, trained and done work as an electrician, that the crack or the sound of the beam sounded electrical to him. But then, you know, when we got a hold of the police file, one of the interviews with the men described it as looking like a long blue flame. So whether it was a beam or a bolt of lightning or a flame-like thing, I can't say what kind of energy it was, but I'm certain that special effects people could have done a lot more with that if, you know, if it were done right. I've been looking into the possibility of getting the movie redone, because for years I've gotten a steady stream of emails from people that said, okay, I've read the book and I've seen the movie, and I just think that it would have been a better movie if they'd told the real story. I didn't have a single comment from anyone who thought that Hollywood had improved on what happened. So the way it could be done, Paramount's right to a sequel expired a long time ago, and the part aboard the craft could be shot as a flashback, and since they didn't tell it how it really happened, you could do it as it really was, and you wouldn't be duplicating anything that they did. So I think there's a huge number of people who would like to see the movie done true to life. But, you know, I'm not completely unhappy with the movie. It does, you know, make people walk out of the theater with the same kind of emotional impact that we had back then. It's like as if they lived through it. It just would have been better, I think, in some ways, to stick more to the facts.
Oh, I agree. I would love to see them redo it and do it right, so to speak. Because, just the idea of being dragged through a bunch of nasty garbage like they showed in the movie just didn't strike me as being very realistic.
Opposite. Just the exact opposite. You know, they had it all organic and cluttered when it was actually very sterile and mechanical and metallic inside.
Oh gosh, yes. It just well, to me, you know, because I had read the book first, and I just couldn't understand why they would, you know, portray it that way.
Yeah, I don't think it was a good choice. You know, hundreds of people have told me so, but you know, there were some things that were actually better, surprisingly. lot of trouble breathing, and really, you know, that was something that was what set off my total lack of control. My hysteria was the feeling of suffocation, not being able to breathe. But had they shown an actor standing there breathing hard and looking panicked, you wouldn't really understand that it was because of being unable to breathe. So the scene where the actor has a membrane over his face and he's opening his mouth and struggling to breathe does a much better job of imparting to people, you know, what would it be like if you suddenly had your mouth and nose covered, you know. I think that helps them see what I lived through there.
I think that's probably why the one that came and got you had a helmet on.
Yeah, I kind of suspect that, too. It might have been just in case. I don't know. But you know, the people he left me with weren't wearing helmets, and they didn't go inside that craft, so that's a good possibility.
Oh, gosh. Let's see. We've got about a minute before we go to break. Oh, gosh. I've got so many questions in my head, I don't know where to go. I've been wanting to get you on here for so long.
Well, you know, I haven't been back there in years, but I think I'm going to go back this summer. In the daytime, of course, but... and just kind of see what happened with the trees, because there was some real strange growth acceleration of the trees closest to where the craft came down.
Oh, that's right. You did mention that, didn't you?
Yeah, there's pictures of in the book of the core samples taken from these trees that show that from up to the time of the incident, the growth rings were uniform and all fairly thin, and then suddenly became much, much thicker for every single year up to the present day. But something that was suggested to me recently was to check the trees near where the craft came down that brought me back, and nobody's ever thought of that before, and it just amazes me that after all this time nobody thought of that. And so that's something else I want to check out with in the near future.
Oh, interesting. Can you get back into that just a little bit more after our break? And we'll be back here with Travis Walton on Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. Now here's your host, DeAndrew.
Here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, also broadcast live on UPRN 105.5 New Orleans. I'm your host, DeAndrew, and tonight we've been talking with Travis Walton. During the break, Travis, we were discussing on where people can go to get the updated version of your book.
Yeah, I just haven't had a lot of luck with my middlemen, so the only place to get it is from me. And so I'll have more ordering information on the website in the future. But for right now, just email me through the website, and I'll get back to you with all the details on ordering.
Fantastic. And that will be up on your website here in a few days, right?
Yeah, hopefully. But meanwhile, if they want to come to somewhere I'm speaking personally, they can at least save the shipping and handling and get it from me in person. I'll be speaking at the Roswell Museum this July 3rd. And... also, at Tennessee MUFON this fall, And, you know, this is also information I need to get updated on the website. There's a really big gathering at some the Paranormal and Horror Festival in Lexington, Kentucky. Something like 10,000 people. It's called Scarefest. And I'll be speaking there. And this is something I've never done before, but it should be interesting. And also, the International UFO Congress. I spoke at their Laughlin conference, but that's being moved to the Fort McDowell Casino in Phoenix, and I'll be speaking again there in next February.
Oh, and that one we're planning on attending. I didn't want to take any more listeners' questions really quick. I wanted to get more into the book, but this one I have to ask. This one's from Linda Keeper, and she asks, after all the time that you have stayed out of the public eye, what made you decide to rewrite the book and become a public figure again?
Well, you know, I probably, you know, it was just the continual pressure. For years I was just working at the paper mill and was really too busy to bother with it, and I was just working all kinds of overtime and didn't have the energy. But I was getting almost daily inquiries from people of, where can I find the book? And, you know, they were complaining that they go online and people are selling their used copies for outrageous prices, sometimes $200-$300. And so, you know, that was the reason. It was just, you know, popular demand. Plus, you know, there's been some developments that I'd like to share with people. So, you know, there's some new illustrations, and I think it'll be interesting. I really like the look of the new book. It's just a lot better quality-wise, and even the parts that aren't revised are just a lot easier on the eye because it's just higher quality paper, and the font and format is just clearer than it was done before.
You know, some of can you kind of give us a hint of some of the updates that are in there?
Well, can't think of them all right now. There's really too many. A lot of it has to do with where people are and what they've been doing and things like that. Some people have passed away. You know, Mike Rogers, he's had some serious health problems. He was in the hospital here a year ago, even though we really weren't on speaking terms much. Anyway, I went to see him. And they couldn't figure it out. And it was really, the doctors just couldn't understand it. But finally here a few months ago, he went in and had some bridge work removed, and he walked in, you know, dragging his right-hand side, and left walking normally. And this bridge work wasn't even attached in any way. It was in contact with any living tissue, but it was just some sort of metal toxicity, some sort of reaction that was just making him really, really sick. Of course, he hasn't completely recovered from that, and he did have some hospitalization here a month or so ago. But he got out a lot better just from getting that metal out of his mouth. So no telling what kind of alloy they had there.
Wow. Interesting.
I didn't think he was going to live through the year, but he's still kicking. As far as I know, all of the crew members are still around.
As you were talking earlier about the growth rate of the trees,
yeah,
and whatnot, is a lot of that covered in the book as well?
Yeah, it was kind of curious that, and there wasn't that much interest. Here was physical evidence that remained, you know, the radiation readings might have dissipated to normal. The magnetic readings might have gone back to normal. But you know, an alteration in the growth of the trees, which should have been something researchers would have wanted to follow right up on. But it wasn't until quite a bit later that I guided Linda Moulton Howe to the site, and she gathered some samples of soil and organic material that was taken to the lab. And so I've seen a little preliminary work done on that, but that's not completed yet. So there may be updates in the future on that, but it'd probably just be, you know, something I put out on the website, or maybe add some pages in the back or something.
Go ahead.
A while back, I learned something kind of curious. One of the guys on the crew, I found out, has been going back to the site on the anniversary of the incident and camping out overnight. That just flabbergasted me. You know, why would any? I said, Ken, you do not want something like this to happen to you. But he apparently thinks that was who was intended or something. I don't know.
I couldn't understand that either. I hear a lot of people saying, "Oh, I wish E.T. would come and take me."
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've heard that asked of you know, by people who have never had that kind of experience, to people who've had lifetime experiences like that, and it just makes myself and these other people kind of chuckle. Why would you want that?
Yeah. Well, you know, that was something that came up in that Stephen Hawking interview on Larry King. You know, Stephen Hawking was sort of criticized for saying that he didn't think it was wise to, you know, be sending out signals to E.T., you know, going on his assumption that they're not already here, to let them know we're here before we're prepared to defend ourselves, you know, that could be not in our best interest. And, you know, I can understand that from his point of view, especially if you understand that as being that if we don't know what their intentions are, it's better to err on the side of caution. That doesn't mean when they land we open fire, but, you know, to be careful and be, you know, ready for anything, including ready to be friendly if that's what the situation warrants. But do we know, you know? Yeah, I mean, they could be friendly, but are you going to bet your life on it, you know? You know, even people who acknowledge that they're here, you know, I don't know how certain they can be. I know I'm not certain of what their intentions are.
Well, I put it this way. If they intended harm, they wouldn't have brought you back, and they wouldn't have brought back all these other people that they have abducted over the years.
Yeah, and, you know, that speaks very strongly to me. But I did an interview with a Canadian radio host here recently who reminded me that that there was a major UFO sighting at the time of my return on November 10th, the night that I called for help after being returned, was the same night of the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. And, you know, since this disc jockey is up there in the Great Lakes region, he was very close to this. And he said that fighter jets were actually scrambled to a point over where that ship went down. Now, the Discovery Channel devoted a whole hour to, you know, the mysterious cause of this wreck, as explaining it that there was this rogue wave that came along and broke the ship in half. But the distress call was sent out and responded to fairly quickly. The lake at the point where the ship went down was so shallow that if the ship had been whole, that the one point of the boat could have been hitting the bottom while the rest of it was still above the surface. So it's not all that deep, and yet, in spite of the fact that recovery and rescue people were there almost immediately, not a single crewman was ever recovered. And so, you know, he believes that it could have been a mass abduction in which people weren't returned. 29 people vanished, and there's no sharks to eat them, and the lake's not that deep, and so where'd they go? Why wouldn't they find at least one of them? They were looking and looking and looking almost immediately. But, you know, at the time that this was happening, I was calling my brother-in-law, and this is just a coincidence, but my brother-in-law's name is Grant, and one of the missing crewmen on the Edmund Fitzgerald was named Grant Walton. But are you familiar with Gordon Lightfoot's song, The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald?
Yes, I am. Yeah. I did some time in the Navy, and during my initial training and my job training, was a guy whose uncle was on the Edmund Fitzgerald.
You know, there's quite a few interesting coincidences that happened in connection with this incident. I list some of those in the book, but, you know, that's not necessarily, you know, meaning that there's anything significant about it other than just an interesting coincidence.
And, you know, I was unaware of them scrambling jets that night because there was a heavy storm that night.
Yeah, and so this would have had to have been at very high altitude, but I'd forgotten all about that. As a matter of fact, I didn't even get that into the updated edition. He just reminded me about that after it was already printed, and I'd forgotten that he'd said anything about scrambling jets. But that's interesting. I'd like to be able to document that some way.
Oh, that makes two of us. That's an interesting incident. It was really good. We have another question here from our virtual auditorium. This is from Cartoonist, and he would like to know, how has your health been since this incident?
Well, I'm extraordinarily healthy. I just don't get sick hardly, you know. The ill effects that I might have had would have been immediately afterwards, just stress-related things, lack of sleep, that kind of thing.
Dehydration.
Huh?
And dehydration.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, the stress symptoms, you know, rash and that kind of sort of thing was, you know, continued for a number of weeks and months after that, you know, because my sleep was extremely disrupted and a lot of nightmares and stuff. You know, and just while I was waking, it was this constant state of fear. You know, it was a while to just get calmed down, so it's understandable that there would be a little bit of the body not being able to keep up with that kind of stress.
Interesting questions being bantered around in the virtual auditorium. Whether or not you remembered this consciously, or were you hypnotized to remember?
Well, I did remember everything that was related under hypnosis, but the hypnosis was a major step forward because I had been so traumatized by what happened, I couldn't even get it out. I'd start to talk about it, and I'd break down. It's just so, so horrible to talk about. But the hypnosis was, it allowed me to sort of compartmentalize, to separate the stress of my reaction from the experience. And so, you know, that was really the first time that anyone back on Earth had heard what happened to me.
And now people are asking, who hypnotized you?
It was Dr. James Harder. He was an Aerial Phenomena Research Organization Director of Research. He was a professor at the University of California at Berkeley.
Interesting. A professor. Gosh, I wonder if that was inspiration for John Mack to get into it as well.
I don't know. John Mack was certainly, utilizing his particular specialty, in investigating, because he was, in psychology or psychiatry or something. He was qualified to actually, do therapy, that sort of thing. Although I did never undergo any hypnosis with Dr. Mack. Unfortunate what happened to him.
That was sad. Very sad. The new book. I'm wanting to get my hands on it so I can read it. Because I've read the original one, two or three times. And the part of it that I've read the most was the section that tells about what happened with you that night, or over the course of the 5 days, rather. Excuse me. And I had, when I first got into the group that I'm in now here, we had a bunch of us that would just meet in Pal Talk, and I would be asked a lot about your case. And I was surprised at how many people had not read the book. They were just going by the movie.
Yeah.
And I got so tired of repeating myself that I don't know whether you went and looked at it and read it. The link I sent you on the condensed version, so to speak, of that section of your book. When people come up and talk to you about this, do they say, well, I just know your story from the movie, or I've never read the book, or
yeah, what? I do get that quite often. There's quite a few people who, just by their remarks, are going completely off the movie rather than the book. And, I just hasten to tell them, you want the real story, you got to read the book. And, I tried to be as thorough as absolutely possible. But, I got one email yesterday that I have to laugh at, because I've gotten a couple of those over there. They say, well, the movie and the book are different, so which one do I go by? Like, who wouldn't understand that Hollywood is the one who fictionalizes stuff, I'm telling you what really happened. And Hollywood takes a story. Let this be a lesson to you. Anytime Hollywood does a real-life story, if it's dramatized, it's fictionalized. Count on it. They never tell it exactly how it happened. I guess they think real life is too boring.
I agree with that very much. If I see a movie that's based on true events, then I go and see the movie to enjoy the movie, to enjoy the story. But later I'll go on and find out the true facts behind the story.
Yeah.
The movie, I thought, though, did a pretty good job of showing the stress and the emotional trauma that the men that were with you.
Yeah. So for the emotional experience, the movie. You want the facts, get the book. And that's the way it is with any true life story.
If you were able to get them to redo the movie and more accurately depict what happened to you, would you agree to them using CGI to depict the little guys?
Yeah, definitely. That's so advanced, that they would definitely be able to get to what actually happened the easier that way. It would be possible to do the story probably more economically than ever before. Anything they could do inside a computer is going to be generally less expensive. instance, of
trying to do makeup. Interesting question here in the virtual auditorium. This one's from Gossamer, and he asks, when I met you in Roswell, you seemed a bit standoffish when I mentioned I had experiences. Have you been approached by other abductees, and how do you feel about them wanting to share their experiences with you?
Well, my way of coping with what happened to me has been to sort of shy away from what happens to other people. I've got enough to deal with, you know. And for one thing, you know, there was this claim, which was totally, you know, bogus, that because I'd had a family member who had had a sighting years before, that somehow made my own experience suspicious. But as I pointed out in the book, you know, 1 in 7 people have had an experience or have seen something, you know. So everybody's got at least 7 friends or relatives. So to know somebody who's had an experience is not a suspicious coincidence. It's an overwhelming likelihood. But, you know, the accusation, well, he's a UFO buff, was bandied about quite a bit back then. Well, if it's just stupid, it wasn't true. But it wasn't true because I wasn't a student of the subject, and I didn't suddenly become a student of the subject because, you know, I was working so hard on trying to deal with my own experience. People ask me about other people who have made reports, and I've acknowledged that there are many valid sightings and experiences that are, you know, important part of the research. But on the other hand, I also acknowledge that there are a number of them that I don't think are in that category at all. But I have been completely against ever speaking out and pointing to which cases I thought were valid or good ones and ones that aren't. And that's just because I felt so offended by people who were passing judgment on my case on the basis of nothing. You know, it's kind of like people who attack Arizona's immigration law without having read it. It's people are attacking my case without having looked at the evidence. And so in my book, I quote Emerson, "Condemnation without investigation is the height of ignorance." So I've got to live by that creed, and I'm not going to pass judgment or validate other people's experiences unless I've investigated them. You understand, I have to have the facts first in order to be fair to everyone, including, you know, the standard that I want my case to be judged by.
That's a very commendable attitude. I applaud you, sir. Another question here from our virtual auditorium, this one from New York Lily, and she asks, have you had any experiences, either UFO or paranormal related, since your experience in 1975?
Well, probably the only one I'd talk about would be, you know, I was, somebody called me up and said, "Look up in the sky." And the sun had gone down and there was this huge glowing disc crossing the area. And they were saying that they were like 20 miles away and they were seeing it. This was huge. So I got my digital camera, and it's got a digital zoom and an optical zoom, and I zoomed up there and I could see that this was a huge weather balloon, and it even had these 4 leg-like appendages evenly spaced around the rim. I don't know why it was all flattened out like that, but apparently it was so high, it was up high enough to where the sun that had already set was shining on it and giving off this ethereal glow. But there were reports that the way over in Apache County that, you know, one officer was saying to another, one police officer, "Do you see what I think I see?" You know, but there was also a report that a plane landed at the airport and said that they'd flown up to investigate, and that this thing was a quarter of a mile across, which I doubt. That was what he said, but it couldn't be that big. But it was definitely very huge to be seen by observers so far apart, and to be so high in the air that the sun would still hit it, even though it was dark where we were at. So that was a kind of a false alarm, but really got me going. You know, if I've said it many times that if anything more was to happen, I doubt I'd come out with it, you know, and go public with it, because this is something that just happened to me, and it was worldwide news by the time I was returned, and so, you know, I didn't volunteer to come forward, and it's brought a lot of negative in my life, so why bring more on, you know?
I have heard the same philosophy from a lot of people who have come forward reporting a variety of experiences from UFO to paranormal, but they said if they had to do it again, they kept their mouth shut. Another quick question here from our virtual auditorium. This again from Gossamer, and he asks, was the family member's sighting here in Arizona?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was, and it was in the mountains here in the forest.
Oh, I haven't spent much time up in that part of Arizona, but boy, one time I've been through there, it's beautiful country.
Yeah, it sure is. It used to be a lot more beautiful, but we had the gigantic forest fire here a while back. The Rodeo Chatiskai fire burned 500,000 acres.
Oh, my. Another question from our virtual auditorium. This one from Dimensional Star, and she asks, have you ever run across anyone you can relate to on some level that has had an experience that makes you feel a bit less alone in what happened?
Yeah, there are occasionally people like that, but of course I would, like I said, not name anybody.
Don't blame you. While we got a break in listener questions, silly me, I forgot to have you mention your web address.
Yeah, it's traviswalton.com. And Travis-Walton works, I believe. Travis_Walton works. I don't know, it might even be that Travis Walton all run together works, but I would go with Travis-Walton, and that'll get you there for sure. And then just click on, you know, my personal contact information, and, you know, I'll tell you whatever about the book. Or if you just want to ask a question, I can do that too.
Oh, now here's an interesting question. This one's from Skymon, and Skymon asks, what do you do outside of UFOs? Any hobbies to relax or other interests?
Oh, yeah. You know, I've rebuilt some car engines, and I like to work on my motorcycles. I have lots of outside interests, you know. Been looking at petroglyphs recently. That's kind of, for some reason, keeps coming up to me, especially some that are in the canyon near here that seem to be representations, and, you know, these things are hundreds of thousands of years old, but of beings that might not be human, or even disc-shaped craft. And so those kind of petroglyphs are being found in different places all over the United States. But we have some right here in the canyon outside of our snowflake.
I was unaware of that. We're going to have to go check that out. We went and saw some at a place that, gosh, I used to drive by it every day back and forth to work, a place called Hedgepath Hills, that the whole east side of this hill, there's all these big lava rocks, and they're just covered with petroglyphs. And that's fascinating.
I've also gone out fossil hunting with my grandson and found quite a few fossils. I think I'll take those over to the university and see what they came out from.
Oh, that would be interesting. You know, in all this that comes down on you with Philip Glass and the media hounding you and all this, how did you keep your sanity? How did you keep from just going absolutely berserk?
Well, some people might think that's debatable, whether I succeeded or not. But, you know, I really did kind of compartmentalize. It's actually called denial. And that's not really a recommended strategy with most therapists, you know, but it worked for me, you know. And, you know, this relates back to the question about people, you know, not understanding me, not getting into other cases. I just sort of boxed it up and set it aside and tried to live as normal of a life as possible. I didn't let the topic dominate home life. So my kids grew up with a pretty down-to-earth lifestyle, you know, environment here. And that was my goal. And I'm proud to say that I've got a fine bunch of kids, it turns out.
Oh, well, we drove through Snowflake on our way home from Roswell last year. We drove through Snowflake and through Heber on down through Payson and down. And, you know, I was, again, you know, had the images from the movie in my head, and I was looking around as we were going through, and I go, boy, this doesn't look anything like it's depicted in the movie.
The movie was filmed in Oregon.
That explains it. I lived in Idaho for many years, and I kept thinking, gosh, that looks like the forest around here. Another question that's popped up in here, and I want to add on to it just a little bit of my own. This one is from Joseph, and he asks, would you tell us the approximate location of this encounter? And my addition onto it is, what was the approximate location of where you returned?
Well, I used to give the approximate location of the return all the time because I didn't see any harm in that. But now that I'm going to go check the trees for altered growth, maybe I shouldn't be doing that. But the reason I haven't given people directions, and I've had a number of requests to the exact site, is that I didn't want any mischief going on. You know, the tree growth, those trees are still there and growing. This could be very valuable in the future as to what's causing this. And so, you know, if somebody was to learn of that and go up there and cut them down just so they could get a sample of it or something, they could ruin a lot of important data. So for that reason, I haven't wanted to give out anything like GPS coordinates or anything.
Oh, well, I understand that. And for the incident, the encounter, that was somewhere along, what was it, Turkey Ridge?
Well, it was at Turkey Springs, which is, it wasn't right at Turkey Springs, but it was on the area surrounding that. That was the name of the thinning contract that we were cutting on.
Okay.
But okay. It was, you know, right up near the top of the Mogollon Rim, south of Heber. Near the Apache Indian Reservation boundary.
Interesting.
Which is also the Rim Road that goes right along the reservation boundary.
And I just got a private message from one of our audience members who says to please tell Travis thank you for your honesty and sincerity.
Well, you're welcome, but, you know, all I can do is this is what happens.
Oh, gosh. Let's see. And this return location, was it like north of Heber, south of Heber? You don't have to give an exact, you don't need a road name or anything.
I would call it west of Heber.
West of Heber. Okay. Interesting. You know, I'm a big map freak, and I'm always trying to put, you know, look on a map to see locations and to get my brain functioning. So, okay, this happened there, this happened
there. It was
there.
Just outside the edge of town, and, you know, it's probably inside of Heber city limits now, but I guess that's just about as close as they could get me to town without being seen, you know. Maybe that's why they chose Heber rather than the town where I live, which is Snowflake. Heber's just the town nearest where it happened. And it has these deep canyons that would make it easy for something to fly below radar or, you know, ability for people to see them so much. Whereas Snowflake's in this big, wide, low valley that, you know, would they'd be seen for sure.
I after having driven through both areas, I can see your point there and understand completely, most definitely.
Yeah, those high canyon walls probably was good camouflage for them. Unless they just didn't have any idea I lived in Snowflake and just went for the town nearest. I'm just grateful they didn't drop me off in the woods somewhere or someplace farther away that I'd never make it back.
Again, that showed some consideration for your safety.
Yeah. I was so weakened that I don't think I could have made it all the way to town from Turkey Springs.
Well, do you have any memories of being returned or how you got there?
Well, I just woke up in time to see the craft leave. I was face down. It was cold. Air, you know, just and cold ground, and I could see light coming from above, and when I looked up to see where it was coming from, it went off.
Was it the same craft or
a no? It was one of those ones that I saw earlier, the shinier one, the more rounded one, and it went straight up real fast. Even in my mentally shocked state of mind, I still marveled at how fast it moved without making a sound. Kind of sucked in a little air behind it, but it didn't scream through the air. For something that big to suddenly be just a dot, I just don't understand why it wouldn't shriek through the air.
Wow, that's absolutely amazing.
You know, like a bullet makes a crack,
sonic boom.
Kind of a sonic boom sort of thing, yeah.
Oh, we have just a little under 5 minutes left. Is there anything that you want to get out personally to our listeners?
Well, I would just, you know, ask them, you know, in judging anything in ufology, no, in anything, politics, commercial products, anything, get the facts first. You know, don't pass judgment on anything without having good, solid information first. Then you can form an opinion. People who go without facts sometimes say, well, it's just my opinion. Well, if you don't have any facts, you don't have a right to even have an opinion. Really? Of course, in the legal sense, of course, you have the right to do it, but you're talking about the moral right. You're not morally right to pass judgment without, well, something to base it on. So that's all I really ask of people is look at the evidence first.
I agree with that thoroughly. Again, when I referring back to the consent, account that I put together, I put at the bottom, you know, go see the movie for the entertainment, then go and find out the true story behind the movie.
Yeah. And this goes to whether you're going to form a negative opinion or a positive opinion. Either way, have the information first. You don't want to believe something without basis any more than disbelieve something without basis.
Exactly. We have about 3 minutes left. If you'd like to tell where you're speaking again and website address.
Yeah. We can have them write to me at traviswalton.com, travis-walton.com, or I'll just go ahead, since we've had time, give them my personal email address, traviswalton@cableone.net, and Cable One is spelled out CableOne, cableone.net, traviswalton@cableone.net, and that'll give me an email straight to me.
And you'll be speaking then at Roswell this year?
Yeah, I'll be speaking at the museum there.
And at the conference here in Phoenix,
mm-hmm,
this coming spring?
Yeah. And then there's some other ones that aren't confirmed yet, in Mexico City or Istanbul, and those are next year and not really confirmed yet.
Wow, going international.
Well, I spoke in Bavaria last October and also in Istanbul.
Oh gosh, there's a lot of people in our virtual auditorium that are thanking you for joining us tonight. They're people were all excited when they found out you were going to be on here tonight.
Well, I'd like to thank your listeners for tuning in.
And I'd like to thank them for coming up with all these really great questions.
Yeah, good questions.
Okay, let's see.
I was talking to Colin Andrews here recently, and he thought of something that I hadn't thought of. Said, very often when people are under anesthesia or unconscious, they still remember things that go on around them. And he was suggesting that maybe I might have recorded information about while I was unconscious.
That would be interesting.
So that's interesting. That kind of makes me think some of these vivid dreams I had way back might have had some information in them. Of course, nothing I can remember. They just all seem like fragments of something.
That's interesting. That's an aspect I hadn't thought of, and it would be interesting to find out. But unfortunately, we are all out of time tonight. Never seems to be enough. Thanks again, Travis, for being on. I deeply appreciate it, and so does my audience. They're all in there saying thank you.
All right. Thanks, Dee. We'll be talking again sometime.
Oh, most definitely. And unfortunately,
all right,
That's all the time we have for tonight. I would like to thank everyone for tuning in and also thank all those who joined us in the Palfoc Auditorium. Stay tuned for Voice of the People, hosted by November Hansen. Her guest tonight will be David Paul Doyle. Please join us again next Saturday for Eye to the Sky, the UFO synopsis. Until then, keep an eye to the sky. Good night, everyone.